Chris was also the immediate past president of the International Federation of Journalists, I think, for 9 years. I think that role has been instrumental in really broadening the reach of the IFJ, particularly down to our part of the world, the Asia Pacific region, which has been a great help. His other claim to fame is that he's a Roosters fan, so he's quite happy today. So, Chris.
Thanks, folks. I had my major job today as intended referee in the Roosters Warriors game last weekend as well. Of course, I always find coming to New Zealand to talk to journalists both fascinating and to a degree alarming because it's fascinating because so many of the things that are happening in journalism and the media here in New Zealand are happening also in the media in Australia. And I guess alarming because so much of the things that are happening here in New Zealand are also happening in Australia. As Brett said, I'm here in two capacities. First, as the former president of the International Federation of Journalists, which is the global organisation of journalist organisations. And I want to say a few words about the state of our craft around the world and the challenges that face us as a global profession. And then as the Federal Secretary of the Media Alliance, the union which represents Australian journalists, that indeed represents media workers in Australia. I'd like to talk to you about the recent changes within Australia, particularly the changes to media ownership laws, and the effect they are having as journalists face what is probably a much greater paradigm shift than we went through in the end of hot metal as we move into the online age. But even as we look at the benefits that technology almost certainly brings to our craft, we also need to reflect on the approaching shadows. And I think these shadows are cast by three fundamental crises that threaten the free and independent practice of journalism and indeed the very craft of journalism itself. And these intertwined crises are a crisis of press freedom, a crisis of safety, and a crisis of the way we work. And these crises are putting pressures on all journalist unions and indeed on journalists. Although, as I think the fact that you've all come here together over this weekend shows, journalists, media workers and their unions are fighting back. Now, the scale of the crisis of press freedom is exposed by one simple fact. In almost every country, on every continent, press freedom has been diminished over the past 3 years. Indeed, these past few years have been a chilling reminder that freedom does not fly like an arrow, always pushing forward. It demands continued defence. In established democracies, governments are falling back onto national security as the justification for ever-increasing restrictions on reporting. Governments, police, courts are all driving a global assault on our professional obligations to protect confidential sources. In Australia just this week, new sneak and peek anti-terror legislation proposed by the Howard government would give security agents and the federal police the freedom to walk into newsrooms, even unoccupied newsrooms, seize reporters' phones and laptops, and even plant bugs within newsrooms without having to tell the subjects of their surveillance. Meanwhile, two journalists who ran with a story the government didn't like, for no reason other than that it embarrassed them, were fined $7,000 for refusing to betray their source, while another reporter on the national newspaper, The Australian, was forced into hiding to avoid a subpoena aiming to force him to name his confidential source. And while we've had some success recently in getting governments at state and federal level to commit to shield laws for journalists, the protection they offer journalists are weak and are totally undermined by the lack of protection offered to whistleblowers. And I must say the experience in Australia is not an Australian experience. That attack on confidentiality of sources and on the involvement of journalists, the engagement of journalists in therefore legal action or legal prosecution as a result of our protection of our sources is a global phenomenon across democracies. And meanwhile, of course, in less established democracies, we're seeing many of the gains made in the past decade being wound back by a spreading neo-authoritarianism. existing dictatorships are entrenching their power. That means too many of our colleagues around the world are in jail or detention. And I particularly want to mention two. Ching Chiong, the Hong Kong-based correspondent for the Singapore Straits Times journalist, who was jailed in China last year on spurious charges of spying for attempting to get the last will and testament of former Communist Party Secretary Zhao Jian. And meanwhile, the Al Jazeera cameraman, Sami Al-Haj, sits in Guantanamo Bay, where he has sat for almost 6 years now, having fallen foul to the other world's superpower. And he's been there since being abducted from Pakistan in late 2001, designated as an enemy combatant, despite his obvious professional accreditation, and, like his fellow detainees in Guantanamo, has yet to be given the chance to defend himself in court. And as journalists, as journalist unions, and as the International Federation of Journalists, we have to commit to continuing to fight for the freedom of Sami Al-Haj and Ching Chiong, and for all the other journalists around the world who are being held in captivity simply for doing their job. The crisis of safety is probably in many ways the most heartbreaking of the crises that we face. Year after year, we see new records of the number of journalists and media workers who are killed carrying out their work. We see the extreme manifestation of this crisis in Iraq, but we see the same contempt for journalism in too many countries, and in too many countries, the killers are getting away with it. I think of the journalists who've been murdered in the past 10 years, there's about 1,000 of them. In 80% of cases, no one has ever been even arrested for the crime. Now, the crisis of work, which I know you've been talking about a lot today, is challenging the nature of journalism. Those with full-time jobs around the world report they are working harder than ever, and yet more and more journalists are engaged in some form of contingent work, as freelancers, as casuals or contractors. Our employers seem to be losing confidence in journalism, that they've come to believe that media are short-term investments, that many of the media have no long-term future. And so corporate strategies seem to be more about maximising short-term profits through cutting costs than making the long-term investments in quality that are crucial to the survival of our industry and our craft. These changes are, of course, reinforcing inequalities in journalism, particularly the historic patterns of discrimination against women. They're driving employers to be more aggressive in challenging settled social compacts, to attempt to wind back long-won and settled rights. In countries from South Asia, North America, Latin America, here in New Zealand and at home in Australia, employers are using individual contracts to undermine collective agreements and the very independence of journalism. Critical components of the creative process of journalism are being devalued and outsourced, as of course you know very well here in New Zealand. And much of this is an inevitable byproduct of the continuing gradual consolidation of media ownership, which is challenging democracy, not just here in New Zealand, not just within the Australian-New Zealand economic space of the media, but around the world. And indeed, the more concentrated media ownership becomes in any one market, the more powerful its owners become, and the more likely it becomes that those owners will be given the chance to own yet more of the media cake in the future. As I'm sure you know, in Australia we're awaiting a federal election which is expected to take place at some time toward the end of this year. And so all the political pundits are playing the game of which way will Murdoch jump. It happens before every election, usually preceded by pictures of Murdoch's lieutenants visiting either the incumbent or his challenger, and is inevitably followed, once the dust settles on the poll, by one or another concession, often in terms of deregulation of media ownership. Now, after a decade of humming and hiring after media ownership regulations, the present government's relaxed the media ownership laws late last year. When announcing the changes, the Minister for Communications, Senator Helen Coonan, argued that the continued rise of new media would effectively render old media regulation redundant. In other words, she argued, government controls were like the proverbial Dutch boy with his finger in the dike, increasingly being breached, a dike increasingly being breached by the growth of blogs, providing a vast array of independent voices. Now, of course, those of us in journalism know that this is a furphy. How many Australians or New Zealanders get their main news and opinion from blogs? I think all the indication is not many, indeed. Not even the bloggers get most of their news and opinion from other blogs. Overwhelmingly, newspapers and other mainstream media, including particularly public broadcasters, remain the major conduit of news and opinion in Australia. And indeed, we can't forget that most of the most visited news websites are owned by old media companies in any case. Within Australia, the top four most popular websites are all owned by either the Fairfax Company, News Limited, or the Packer interest through PBL. So the new media landscape under the new laws in Australia looks like this. In any given market, at any given time, the number of media ownership must make up to make 5 points. That is, there must be five independent voices. So in Sydney, say, News Limited's newspaper, magazine and pay TV holdings make up 1 point. Fairfax with its newspapers and radio domination makes up another. PBL makes up a third. The Seven Network and Macquarie Media make up the five core voices that are required in Sydney. So did the proprietors like the changes? Well, you bet they did. In the weeks after the lifting of restrictions, there was a flurry of deals that continues to this day. News Corp spent $175 million to buy the 25 titles in Federal Publishing Company's magazine business, making it the third largest magazine owner with 10% of total readers. Number two on that list is Pacific Magazines, which of course is owned by Kerry Stokes' Seven Network, which recently bought out Time Inc.'s magazines in Australia. He's also bought 15% of West Australian newspapers for $193 million and 5% of the Fairfax Group. So his voice and influence is growing ever stronger. And indeed, you might have seen Kerry Stokes delivering the vote of thanks to mark John Howard's 10 years in power. It's no surprise that he's moving the vote of thanks. The past 10 years have been very good for Kerry Stokes, despite his recent spot of legal bother over the C7 case. We're also seeing the rise, not just in Australia, but around the world, of a new breed of media owners, particularly in Australia and the United States, venture capitalists, private equity consortiums, such as Macquarie Media in Australia or CBC, which has made an aggressive, Macquarie Media has made an aggressive play in the radio market, and CBC Asia Pacific, which is, depending on where you stop tracking the bank, is either owned in the Cayman Islands or the Dutch East Indies, West Indies, I should say, which recently bought 75% of the old Packer media empire. Now, it's impossible to know much about private equity ownership of the media, except that we do know that most investors in private media are much more concerned about the bottom line than about such nebulous and perhaps unprofitable, or certainly short-term unprofitable concepts as quality and integrity. And cost-cutting to boost short-term profits so the company can be put back on the market within 3 to 5 years, rather than investing for long-term, is a hallmark of the private equity owner. We have to see what effect their ownership is going to have, but I don't think any of us can be terribly confident. Before I finish, I just want to make a few points about the new player on the media block, the internet, and our experience of it in Australia, and what we're hearing about is adoption by news providers elsewhere in the world and what that means in journalism. There's no doubt, of course, that the internet is an increasing force in the dissemination of news and opinions, despite my dismissive comments about bloggers earlier. But it's a force because around the world, newspapers are reordering their operations to create their versions of the newsrooms of the future, in which the online operations are as important, more so, if you believe, some people, than the printed copy. The UK's Guardian newspaper was an early adopter and remains probably one of the most adept at managing its print and online editions. It was the first major English language masthead, to start running news stories online as they broke, rather than just putting the published paper online. And one of the first to hire dedicated online reporting staff. But now others are fast following suit. In Australia, It was Fairfax who made the early running on the internet, and the Sydney Morning Herald and Asian newspapers were for a while way out in front of the rest in the quality and depth of their internet sites. There's no doubt that one of the reasons that Fairfax has bought the radio operations of Southern Cross in the past month is to provide, is to strengthen and deepen the audio content for its websites as part of its competition with ABC online. Indeed, just last week, I think, or the week before, the figures were released that showed that the Sydney Morning Herald on SMH Online is now the most popular website within Australia, overtaking 9MSN, which is a joint venture, of course, between PBL and Microsoft. But for the past 6 months or so, News Limited has been ploughing a huge amount of money into its online operations of its newspapers to play catch-up. On most of its masthead, its dedicated online staff in the past 12 months has gone from 2 or 3 on each masthead to from 20 to 25 dedicated online staff on each of its mastheads. And of course, we've seen the recent purchase by the News Corporation of the Wall Street Journal operations, which is all about strengthening their online operations and their cable television operations. The pot of gold for all this, of course, is the predicted $5 billion in Australia in annual online advertising revenues within the next 5 years. And we're already at the stage where online advertising is close to outstripping print. That's particularly been the case in classified advertising, where now two or three out of the four categories of classified advertising, trading, jobs, cars, most of the advertising dollars are now, or most of the advertising, most of the advertisements themselves at least, are being put online rather than in print. It's really only real estate as the last part of classified advertising that is still predominantly, predominantly in print, although I don't think any of us can be confident that that's something that's going to endure. So it's a question of, the question for the online classified advertising facing the media organisations is, how do the media organisations keep those classified advertisements in an online environment rather than seeing them go, as they have increasingly gone, to non-media, pure advertising players? Now, the result of all this investment in online is twofold. First, the dream of a media scene being a brave new plurality of small and independent voices using this wonderful new means of production to get to the masses remains just that, a dream. But for the major corporations, Fairfax and News Limited meanwhile, the imperative to get out front and ensure themselves pole position in driving up that pot, in dividing up that pot of advertising gold, if that's not a mixed metaphor, is driving them to huge commitments to their online presence. Commitments which are actually beginning to outstrip the ability of their staff to fulfil them. We're getting regular complaints from journalists that new tasks are being heaped onto them in addition to their full-time jobs. Reporters are now expected to not only write for the paper the next morning, but write regularly breaking reports for the web during the day and to prepare audio and often video content for the web as well as their reports for the next day's paper. Often they're asked to run 24-hour blogs about their area of expertise, particularly this is true of Browns people, while still covering their patch or producing their section. And the pitfalls of this are obvious, not just for the extra pressure this is putting on journalists, and the pitfalls also prove very expensive. Already we've seen News Limited's Daily Telegraph fall foul of an expensive defamation suit as a result of this increased workload. It cost the Telegraph nearly $500,000 and a lot of egg on their face after comments on an ill-moderated blog accused a bunch of private citizens, judges, lawyers, whose crime was to provide a character reference for a public prosecutor accused of possessing child pornography. The comment accused them of being perverts themselves. In fact, I think the Telegraph was lucky to get away with $500,000. So the risks involved in the runaway adoption of new technology without many of the traditional cares and checking that is built into traditional journalism is clear. So it's very well to trumpet the virtues of citizen journalism, but in their zeal to provide content without costs, proprietors can't overlook the key role of professional journalists. So, in conclusion, in Australia, New Zealand, around the world, if we're concerned about the future of quality news and those who gather it, and are also concerned about its future, we're right to be concerned. We worry that instead of a healthy and democratic cacophony of voices providing for a range of news and opinions, successive governments in Australia have pandered to the powerful and allowed a handful of companies to dominate the media landscape, including the new media landscape. We worry about what this means for quality, and we're committed to protecting not just the jobs of our members, but their well-being and the sense of meaning that's so central to journalism. And like you, we know this means we have a long struggle ahead of us. Thank you.
Thanks, Nicholas. Well, I was very nippy from discussions this morning and the early part of this afternoon. So, really, any questions or comments? John.
I think if there's one advantage, you can sit back and watch others make mistakes and then not repeat the mistakes. And I like to think that's happened a wee bit with some of the things Fairfax did with the internet in Australia around F2 and lost millions of dollars, I think. But just to capture a couple of points you made at the end there, I think it's incumbent on everybody to be very careful about how they move down this new road. But I think you'd agree too that it's inevitable we have to go there. The ability or the opportunity to stay there purely as print journalists is not sustainable. If current producers and publications don't move into this market, somebody else will. So would you agree that the real emphasis should be on care of the way you do it rather than the fact that you do it?
I think that's right. Look, I think journalists generally welcome the there's a lot that's exciting about the internet, but from a journalistic perspective, there's a lot that's exciting about being able to get news out quickly. It's one of the interesting things about the internet in Australia is it actually hasn't had, unlike the United States, it hasn't had an enormous impact on circulation. And I think the situation is not that different here, that circulation now in Australia is not significantly different to what it was 10 years ago. Advertising is different, but circulation itself is not different. One of the other second interesting things is that the surveys indicate there's very little overlap between online readership and print readership. So I think it's of the print circulation, the surveys show that only, and these are obviously surveys, so you can take them as you wish, only 20% of people who read the print edition of a newspaper read the online edition or any other newspaper. So I think it's interesting. What's interesting about it from a journalistic perspective is not that we just need to engage in it, but that it's in many ways it's a new market. It's a totally new group of readership. One of the things that concerns me about that is I wonder whether people who run newspaper companies are therefore the right people to cater to that new readership. One of the experiences of television is when television came in the 50s and, well, at least in the 50s and perhaps in the 60s, there was an expectation that, which many people still have, that if you could run news in newspapers, you could run news in television. And you can't. I mean, they're different markets and they're very different types of news. So I sometimes kind of wonder whether newspapers have the expertise, I don't know, I could be totally wrong about this, but I do kind of wonder whether they've got the expertise to be the websites, to dominate news websites in the future, or whether they are going to be vulnerable to
to new media. And I know that's actually an issue that a lot of newspaper companies are grappling with. I think it's one of the problems News Limited, for example, has had. How do you grapple with that? So yes, I think we do need to embrace it. I'm not so sure that it necessarily follows inevitably that newspaper companies have no future without being online, nor do I think it necessarily follows that they're necessarily the best people for online.
Chris, just going back to your earlier comments about on freedom issues.
Yep.
I know you're fully aware here, but recent changes to the Evidence Act in New Zealand, amendments that have given greater protection to journalists in terms of protecting their sources, evidence giving, journalists giving evidence in court. Now is assumed to be able to protect their sources unless the judge decides otherwise, or if it's the other way around.
Yeah. And look, and there's a similar laws being introduced in Australia. The problem with those laws is that's actually not where journalists tend to get caught up. The number of journalists who actually end up in court is quite small. The problem is journalists being caught in the earlier stage with subpoenas, searches of newsrooms, bugging, access to their phone records. In fact, in the two major cases, prosecutions of public servants in Australia for whistleblowing, in both cases that the federal police have identified the public servant for prosecution as a result of subpoenaing the phone records of journalists. And that's why, as journalists, this is one of those issues where we need to stop thinking about ourselves so much and start thinking actually about whistleblowers, because they're actually the people who commit the criminal act. And we only really get caught up in the middle of it. And even where we have protection against answering questions in court through shield laws, we can still get caught up through having our phones tapped or having our offices searched. So I think it's important that reform of shield laws, which is important reform, and I think it's been great to get that shift in Australia and New Zealand, almost alone among OECD countries in the past few years. But it's important that we need to keep pushing, recognise that that's actually only going to take us so far, that both for our sake and indeed for the sake of the public democratic debate, the important thing is actually whistleblower protection. Of course, one of the problems of whistleblower protection, which I can say in a group of journalists, don't tell the politicians this, is most whistleblowers are a bit nuts. That's why they become whistleblowers in the first place. Doesn't mean they're not, what they say isn't true or valuable or all the rest of it, but that's actually one of the reasons I think we often find it hard, why we often pull back from giving them the support that they deserve, and also why it's a harder thing to get up with governments.
I'm just kind of interested in your opinion on something. Now, journalism started out as the ear hole of the state and was meant to sort of monitor the governments. In today's world, it's not the governments that have the major influence over what's happening in our world, it's actually the corporations and etc. Now, I sort of see a bit conflict because media should be sort of monitoring these people and keep them honest, but these people own media.
Look, I think that is a big issue. In fact, when we talk about freedom of information laws, for example, which we talk about a lot, it's important to remember that you need to work out a way in which freedom of information laws can apply to private corporations as well as to governments. And I must say, I find that we work in a coalition with called the Right to Know Coalition in Australia, which is us and the major publishers, in fact all the major media owners. And when we talk about freedom of information laws, they're all in favour of it. As soon as we start talking about freedom of information laws applying to private corporations, then they seem to be a lot quieter about that. They don't seem to be as enthusiastic in supporting that position as they do against governments. And indeed, one of the downsides, one of the problems of the growth of private equity, not just in the media but generally, is that when a company becomes privately owned, the reporting obligations of that company are a lot less. So a privately owned company or a company owned by a private equity fund is by definition less accessible to us as journalists, less able for us to report on it as journalists than a publicly listed company. Publicly listed, I wouldn't say publicly listed companies are a paradise for free flow of information, but they are required to report a lot of information that privately owned companies aren't.
Judy?
Chris, I wonder if you could outline for us your ideal
of
cross-media ownership regulation, given that New Zealand, of course, has virtually nothing. You've spoken about the changes in Australia, but we have traditionally had nothing in New Zealand. So what would be the ideal, in your view?
Yes, it was one of the interesting things when we were sort of lobbying senators about cross-media ownership. They always say, but there's no cross-media laws in New Zealand, and the New Zealand media is in the perfect state of vibrant and open debate. To be honest, our position on cross-media laws in relation which prevented ownership of print and television was one that flowed from that was what was in place and that worked. I still think it's important, and I think it does work. Actually, one of the reasons I think it's important is that I don't think there's a lot of evidence around the world that the ability to run a newspaper means you can actually run a television station terribly well, because they're very different. They're very different mediums. I actually think one of the major cross-media challenges at the moment, or cross-ownership challenges for the media at the moment, is the division between carrier and content. So how do you prevent the owners of the pipes in our Australia, that's mainly Telstra, how do you prevent telcos basically also owning media? Because of course when telcos own media, They can therefore restrict other media from getting access to the system. And ultimately, I don't know how many of you follow no one followed terribly closely, because not many people in Australia did, the prosecution between Kerry Stokes and the rest of the media companies in what's called the C7 case. At its heart, that's what that was about. He was arguing that because Telstra and Murdoch own the major cable television network, they were conspiring to prevent him putting his cable channel to air. And he lost his case, but his case was probably a bit of a long shot in a lot of ways. But I think it's nonetheless an important principle that there should be sort of division between carrier and content, and that carriers shouldn't be able to basically own the media because that would do more to freeze out new players than anything else.
Chris, earlier in the day we had a debate about the state of the industry in terms of wage rates and the whole question of the payment of freelancers, and then the question of the crime with collective bargaining of the wage rates there. Could you give us a little rundown about what the state of collective bargaining and the rest of the Australia and the rest of the world is in wage rates?
Yeah. In Australia, collective bargaining, there are collective bargains that cover all bar one of the media companies of any size. The only exceptions are Nine Network, and generally that collective bargaining process over the past 10 or 15 years, collective bargaining as distinct from the award system, came into Australia in 1992. Has probably delivered real wage rises of about 25% for employed journalists over that period. So it's been quite a significant increase. That's journalists aren't alone on that. There has generally been real wage rises through collective bargaining for anybody who's covered by collective bargaining in Australia over that period. But at the same time, of course, there's been increased casualisation and increased use of contract work, of course, got contingent employment, and we haven't seen really any increase in rates for freelancers. The general rate for freelance journalism within mainstream newspapers was 50 cents a word 10-12 years ago, and it's still 50 cents a word now. There's also been, we have seen the use of individual contracts under the Howard government laws, and there are now, and the individual contracts are widespread at Australian provincial newspapers, which is a company you'd be familiar with. All new employees at APN, and indeed anyone wanting a promotion at APN for about 8 years now, has been required to sign an Australian Workplace Agreement, which is an individual contract under Australian law. And probably a majority, probably 60% of the staff at APN are now on individual contracts, notwithstanding the fact that there is also a collective agreement in place. APN was certainly the first company to use individual contracts to cut back conditions for staff too. Journalists generally get 6 weeks and 3 days annual leave in Australia, because we work on public holidays, or available to work on public holidays, and the APN contracts have generally provided 5 weeks annual leave instead of the 6 weeks and 3 days, so there's been a loss of conditions there. Similarly, News Limited, probably about 40 to 50% of the editorial staff are also on individual AWAs, or Australian Workplace Agreements, individual contracts. And so that's acted to hold wage growth back, not because the award rates have been going up, but because people's ability to get merit pay has been diminished. At the same time, there's been a reduction in staff, particularly the Fairfax Group. In the past 3 years, we've had three rounds of redundancies at the Fairfax Group, which seen the Sydney Morning Herald. The staff on the Sydney Morning Herald would have declined from around 500 odd to about 400. So it's been a significant decline in staff, with all the consequent effects of work classification and greater use of outside copy that you would expect.
Peter, last one with Brendan after that, and we'll break for afternoon too.
Thank you. Chris, we had some comments earlier today about people concerned about the having too much celebrity gossip and things like that in the papers, and also we had people suggesting that we need to sample the readers, and basically ask the readers what they want and give them what they want. And I'm very interested to know your feelings on that kind of subject and where you think that kind of thing will lead, because I remember later in Australia once sampled over a couple of lots of cars, and they said on the car with a massive engine, a big boom, and all these various things, and they took the D76 and cracked them another way to avoid it. So I'm very interested to see how you saw that kind of function working with the newspapers. And also, I'm very mindful of the comments about long-term readership being very helpful built by newspapers that make you smarter when you read them. So I'd like to see your thoughts around that.
Look, I think obviously as journalists we write to be read or produce news to be read. But I think it's always important that we listen to what our readers say. I think it is true that often as journalists we're a bit arrogant. We often do tend to think that we know better than other people what they want to know.
You mean we don't?
But having said that, I think often people don't know what they want until they get it. Because how do people get any sense? I mean, to take the great story of Watergate, how could anyone have said in a focus group, "Oh, I want reporting about corruption by the U.S. president," without any sense that that's actually that was actually a possibility? So I think it's. I think all those marketing tools, you know, focus groups, polling, are really valuable input into journalism, but it should be just that, an input. It shouldn't mean that we become mindless ciphers and just do what they say. I'm not convinced that there is this great demand for celebrity gossip that people think in terms of building an ongoing readership or an ongoing audience. There's a big debate in Australia, particularly within the Fairfax Group, within both Fairfax and News Limited, about what sort of news should be online as distinct from what should be in the papers. And the Sydney Morning Herald Online, or SMH Online and the Age Online, are both deliberately much more downmarket celebrity obsessed than the paper, and they say that's because that's what they're, because it's a different readership and that's what their readership want. I suspect that's a bit why I have a bit of this view that I'm not sure the fact you can run a newspaper means you know how to run a website. Because I think the core competency is running a newspaper much more than, or writing for a newspaper rather than it is just being a journalist. Or being a newspaper publisher. I think the core competency is being a publisher, not being a news platform delivery person. And I often wonder whether, and statistically it's inarguable, that celebrity gossip, particularly there's a bit of an element of soft porn in it, does attract greater hits than the Herald Kylie Bum stories, do attract more hits than traditional news stories of. But I think it's open about whether they're repeat hits. That is whether you attract and keep that sort of market, whether you attract and keep that sort of readership, or whether you actually attract and keep them more by having greater doing what we do best, which is news reporting and commentary. What News Limited is doing is interesting because they're actually trying to do both. They're using The Australian as their quality online site, and the Telegraph or whatever their equivalent is in different cities as their sort of their downmarket tabloid site. Their tabloids tend to be more the Sydney Morning Herald. The News Limited tabloids, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, where they're in a competitive market, tend to be more downmarket. I don't mean downmarket and dismissive thing. I mean in a marketing sense, than their tabloids are when they're in a monopoly market in Brisbane and Adelaide, or as they, I think, were in New Zealand.
Chris, you mentioned earlier the freedom of the press and the restrictions caused by low-rated heralds. I'm also interested in exploring the impact of the restrictions on truth. And we've had two high-profile cases across the ditch, in your case, the Hanif case, and now the Upton Tower case, where a man accused of being a terrorist was detained for a number of years without charge. He's currently having a hearing into his security assessment, and media has been unable to report on that hearing despite a huge public interest in the issue. In the Hanif case, on your side of the ditch, you were only really able to report when it got to the criminal stage, when he was making charges and embarrassed to leak the transcripts. In your view, how are these anti-terror laws affecting terms of the ability of reporting to report the news?
Look, there's no doubt they're having a big impact. The Hanif case was really only a big story, became a widely known story because the government mishandled it, because the government was so keen to have its own real life terrorist that it was prosecuting that it was actually quite public about it, and was making these sort of grand statements about it, which were able to be more thanks to journalists than anything else. I mean, that's one of the things that actually always makes you proud to be a journalist, when you see the way journalists, particularly a couple of journalists in particular, just took that case apart and exposed the case. But it would have been just as easy under Australian law for the government to handle all that in secret and deal with that in secret and with a different magistrate. I think that Hanif was a bit lucky in the magistrate he drew. All of that could have been confidential. He could just as easily still be in detention in Australia if the government hadn't been so keen to try and use it as a political stunt. And so it's one of those things that journalists need to continue to watch. Interestingly, I was at a conference a few months ago where one of Australia's leading security correspondents from the ABC was talking about this. She said that the general view she had, she works for the ABC, so she's probably a bit more protection than others, is that the government's never going to go after journalists on these issues. The people they go after are the people who feed journalists, the people we rely on to have someone to put on TV or someone to quote. And it's a lot harder than to whip up media hysteria. If one of us is ever attacked, then we go berserk about it. We're jumping up and down. It's a big news story because we assume everyone's interested in what happens to journalists as we're interested in what happens to journalists. But when it's someone else, you know, happens to a lawyer or someone with an Arabic name, we're a lot less interested in it, and therefore the public find it a lot more. That's one of the ways in which, to use an Australian or popular Australian phrase, but we're being wedged because we're not going too hard on. And I think we do tend to, as journalists, tend to be dismissive of voices when those voices are coming from people with Arabic names than we are with people who come from proper names or from people who are other journalists.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your address, Chris. It's been timely. We'll now break for afternoon tea. If we'll be back, started by 4:10, for the final session.